So it's my great, great pleasure today to have John Fullerton share with us. We actually work from the same building, so I've had the opportunity to learn from him for quite some time, and I thought it would be so wonderful if he could come and share some of those insights with the broader group. John has spent 2 decades working on Wall Street. He was with J.P. Morgan, and he was actually one of the early architects of you know, what you could now call exotic financial instruments. But as he realized the misaligned nature of the current financial system with the broader whole, for lack of a better term, he began walking on a very different path. So, John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here. Privilege.
To get started, I'd love if you could share a little bit more about your first glimpses while you were working at Morgan, when you started to get that sense that there's something off about the system that at the time you were a part of.
Sure. I guess it probably goes back to a question. And what I should say at the beginning is that I worked at a firm called J.P. Morgan, which had a terrific culture for many generations. And so I was and still remain very proud of the work I did there for many years. Many of us who worked there stayed there and worked there specifically because it represented a different culture than a lot of the, the kind of more mainstream or typical ethos that existed on Wall Street. So it may have been a mirage, but we certainly had this feeling that, there was a way to operate on Wall Street and not behave in a way that you couldn't feel good about. And I think the pressures of the business as it got more competitive made that more and more difficult to maintain. But I think to respond to your question, Burju, for me personally, and I don't even really remember when exactly this was, but I began to focus on a question, which was how to reconcile the invisible hand of Adam Smith's capitalism with the golden rule, which is an idea that seems to pervade most organized religions in the world. And I actually organized an adult education conversation around that at our local church, and found the answers very lacking. But also found that it tended to generate a tremendous amount of emotion among the participants. So that was probably the beginning of this questioning period. Mm. And that was long before I left Morgan, I think.
Mm. And you ended up leaving that position a little over a decade ago, and ended up spending many years basically reading about the financial system, what could be due to shift it, and I believe there was a lot of E.F. Schumacher in there as well. Could you talk a little bit about some of those key lessons that you learned as you tried to transition out in the thinking?
Sure. Well, as Burju just mentioned, I left J.P. Morgan in 2001, a little bit before 9/11, and I think experiencing 9/11. Really very much up close. So I happened to be downtown that morning, first time I'd been back downtown since I left working at Morgan. I think that sort of jolted me into what I refer to as my deep think period. And I spent many years doing various entrepreneurial things around investing, but really created a lot of space for myself to read and study and think about these issues. And it started off very much reading some spiritual and philosophical things. And in that process, I really discovered the ecosystem crisis. I was intrigued, Burju, with your story of the priest, because I very much also discovered the ecosystem crisis really in a way that I didn't expect or wasn't even looking for. I had always previously thought of the environmental issues as these sort of disconnected or unconnected one-off problems, you know, a problem about a whale or an owl or something, but I was completely ignorant about the way the ecosystem works and any notion of finite limits, and so reading Limits to Growth was very influential on me, and certainly reading E.F. Schumacher and Herman Daly and Hazel Henderson, I suddenly found there are all these people who were trying to wrestle with the inconsistencies between how we know the biosphere works from a scientific perspective and the assumptions embedded in economic thinking, which was really the kind of the core belief system of modern Western culture, in many ways more powerful than any religion. And of course, that's all grounded in the idea of self-interest, as one of the earlier speakers on this call mentioned. So it was it was a very disconcerting and troubling kind of journey over many years to kind of conclude that much of what we believe to be real and true in our economically centered world system is really built on wrong, you know, not just different values than one might like, but actually scientifically incorrect foundation. And so as a finance person, sort of seeing that finance drives the economy, it all kind of came back, and I was looking in the mirror one day and sort of looked there and said, it's all you, meaning people like me who think they understand how the world works are really operating with some really profoundly serious ignorance about how the world actually does work. So I don't know if that answers your question.
That's very helpful, John. One of the points that you mentioned there, I'd love to dive deeper into this comment of there being limits to growth. And
yeah.
I know the nonprofit that you run, Capital Institute, is focusing on that and how that ties into following the laws of nature. I was wondering
right.
if you could go a little bit deeper into what it means to you to talk about the limits of growth.
Okay. Well, for those that are not familiar with it, there was a study commissioned by the Club of Rome literally 40 years ago now that came out as a book, and it was called Limits to Growth. And the authors created a systems model, which was quite innovative at the time, that didn't actually make a specific forecast, but it ran a series of scenarios about you know, long into the future, what would happen if you continued to grow the global population, and if the global population continued to expand its material well-being and therefore material, you know, resource uses, and it pretty much showed the power of the exponential function and exponential growth that ultimately can't go on forever in a world that is finite. And the book was ridiculed at the time as being sort of a neo-Malthusian, you know, sky is falling type of a treatise. And unfortunately, you know, 30 years later, they wrote an update called Limits to Growth, a 30-year update, which if you're interested, I would recommend reading that book, not the original one, just because it's a shorter and you sort of have the benefit of 30 years of watching what actually happened. And the core idea in that book was that the predictions they were making or the scenarios they were running and their sort of base case scenario was pretty much playing out in the real world as they had anticipated. And of course, the implications of this for an economic system that's predicated on exponential growth and a financial system that, because we run on a debt-based money system, actually demands exponential growth to service the growing debt burden. You know, we've created for ourselves a sort of an impossible conflict. or impossible to resolve conflict without some serious structural reform. And so the Limits to Growth work is very much kind of a foundational insight in a lot of what's now referred to as the new economy movement. And it addresses both the physical impossibility of exponential growth as well as the unjust distribution of wealth that is being created by this system that tends to favor, you know, those with capital over those without capital. So it's sort of a two-pronged movement that but is very much grounded, I think, in the physical limit reality of that was first talked about in Limits to Growth. Actually, it was talked about before that, but that was sort of the work that put it on the in the mainstream in our current generation.
So John, given the philosophical misalignment that you're noticing, a lot of the folks on this call have noticed, and clearly there've been lots of textbooks written on the subject as well, between this current paradigm and you know, the direction that society needs to function in order to be in balance, what kind of advice would you give, or what have you practiced yourself at the ground roots level to start to put all of these thoughts from a systemic perspective into action?
Well, I think there's one very promising idea which is now called impact investing, which is an idea to align investment capital. Let me even back up for a second. What I think is true, and I don't think it's I don't think this is controversial, is that the flow of real investment capital, meaning not, you know, buying or selling a particular stock, but rather the investment decisions being made, particularly by, you know, the large investment decisions that are typically made by either governments or large corporations, you know, building a solar factory to build solar panels versus building or drilling for more oil. These decisions very much define if the economy will have in the future. So I refer to capital investment as the bridge to the economy of the future. And so shifting the flow of that investment capital is essential if we are to end up with an economic system that is both more just and operates within the boundaries of the biosphere. And so one way that some investors are directly engaging in this challenge is to intentionally shift their own investment decisions into projects and businesses that are in alignment with the need for this what I call regenerative economy. And this is the work Burju and I share together. And I suspect some of you are familiar with Burju's work, but as one tangible example, we're along with my partner Larry Lunt at Armonia, which is the company Burju works for. We're sort of applying the methodology of a man named Alan Savory, who practices a holistic ranch management system. We're applying that methodology to the management of ranch land in the United States, Western United States, which has the effect of restoring the grasslands to their natural, healthy ecosystem, the way they operated when the buffalo roamed in the wild. And by using cattle, actually, to replicate or mimic how the buffalo used to roam, we can actually restore the health of the grasslands. And this is just one, you know, small example of how capital investment can actually be put to productive use and creating a, you know, an economic system in the future that's more in alignment with the needs of the planet.
Well, I've certainly been quite inspired by that way of thinking, and yet at the same time, here's a finance guy talking about how to regenerate soil. And to me, that's the interesting juxtaposition, where when you share these types of messages with the establishment, if you will, because you're in this unique position of thinking in this way, and yet, you know, you're in this position to speak to folks that are heading up large organizations on Wall Street. What are the reactions of those individuals, and what would you say are the roadblocks to getting them to think like we do?
Well, I think the reactions are varied, from curiosity to, in some cases, you know, ridicule or dismissal. I think it's fair to say that the mainstream financial world, that their first thought in hearing a story like that will be, well, what are the financial returns? You know, what are the financial implications of it? And fortunately, there's a decent story to tell there, because by making the land healthier, it actually accommodates a more productive ranch, and therefore a more profitable ranch. So there's a bit of a win-win here, both ecologically and financially and socially, for the people that work on the ranch. But overall, when entering into this discussion about aligning investment capital with values and purpose, there's almost an intuitive, instinctive thought that I think goes through most people's minds, which is there must be a cost, a financial cost. And the truth is, they're typically right, because the current economic system systematically profits the financiers at the expense of either the social capital of society, or the ecosystem function or natural capital of the planet, or both. And in fact, one could be cynical and describe capitalism as a way to externalize those costs onto society and onto the planet in order to profit. And I wouldn't necessarily agree that that defines capitalism, but there are certainly many examples of that that exist all around the capitalist system. And so, you know, that though points out the inherent conflict of running the system as it exists. And so it ultimately, at some point, demands of the investor group a recognition that it's in their own long-term interest, and they need to think long-term, to invest in projects that actually are beneficial long-term to society and the planet, as opposed to extractive. But that's a new way of thinking for the mainstream, I would say.
I want to push on that topic, John, because so you make reference to how there are examples in the current paradigm where people are basically using the financial system to create negative value for society and for ecology. Do you think that the direction that you wish to take finance has anything to do with morality?
Oh, I think it's absolutely grounded in morality. I mean, I think we've subconsciously bought into a system you know, allows us to in a sense look the other way. It's not as blatant as it was, you know, a century ago, where you know, slavery is probably the best example. I mean, you know, large plantations were run at the direct expense of freedom of other human beings. You know, what we're doing now is a lot more subtle than that, and it has less kind of directly knowable consequences. But you know, if one accepts the science of climate change, then whether one's a consumer and gets in one's car, like I do almost every day, or an investor and invests in the fossil fuel sector of the economy, one is benefiting from a system that we now know is not only harmful, but potentially catastrophically disastrous for, you know, all life as we know it. And yet, since when we all get in our car and drive down to the store, we don't see that damage. We sort of put it out of our mind. But if one is honest about it, we're all complicit in a system that's ethically unsupportable. Which is, by the way, another reason I find your story of the priest quite intriguing. You know, one of the hypocrisies I've found myself is this, you know, and this is some of the pushback I was getting when we conducted our little conversation, the reconciliation of the invisible hand and the golden rule. You know, everyone would sit in church with their suits on Sunday and you know, listening to all of these moral platitudes, and yet if we were all honest, we were all complicit in a system that was creating far worse long-term consequences than some of the niceties that we would talk about at church on Sunday. And I felt that the organized church has been largely absent in calling out the ethical implications of our economic system.
Well, that does raise an interesting question, John, in terms of the real nitty-gritty of behavioral shift that needs to happen. So if you're working on trying to share these types of messages and you have to fly in a plane to get there, you know, how do you reconcile that type of action and behavior, and what are the mental mathematics that need to take place to justify such action?
So that's a hard question, and I think I wrestle with what to do all the time. Candidly, given what I now sort of my current worldview, in many ways, it would be easier for me to kind of move to a farm and raise chickens and goats and write and reduce my own personal impact, ecological impact, and get in alignment and, you know, in a sense, quote, live happily ever after. But I feel that my experience has given me almost an obligation to try to speak out about this and really try to articulate and put into logic, to communicate or to translate this into language that the financial elites will understand, with the view that a lot of the people that work in finance are actually not bad people. They just don't understand this. And so part of my theory of change is to try to be the bridge to raise awareness and educate a different worldview in this powerful sector of society. And in order to do that, I need to get in airplanes more often than I would like, for many reasons. But I think, you know, we're sort of forced to live in the conflict or even hypocrisy of a belief system and a world system that operates in very much in conflict with it. I'm constantly wrestling with what's the most useful action that I can take and contribution I can make, and frustrated by the seeming impossibility of the task on most days.
So there's a movement from the grassroots that seems to have similar thoughts, similar struggles as tied to the financial system, called Occupy Wall Street, which I'm sure you're familiar with. But what are your thoughts on citizen uprisings and the movement specifically as a path to systemic change?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I sort of laughed at myself because I guess I'm sort of a intellectually oriented person as opposed to a movement-oriented person inherently. And so my response to this awareness was to start a little think tank and start writing and studying and collecting groups of people together to try to wrestle with the sort of the intellectual challenge of how to shift the economy from an unsustainable path to a sustainable path, what some Herman Daly calls a steady state economy that can operate indefinitely. And I laugh at myself because, you know, a year or a year and a half after I started, a bunch of students decided to start a movement and in 6 months obviously raised way more awareness to some of these issues, mostly the inequity issues, I would say, more than the ecological issues. But, you know, they managed to create change the national dialogue in the United States, and I would say even the global dialogue about capitalism, far more effectively than I certainly was with my intellectual approach. So, you know, on the one hand, I'm, you know, completely supportive of a grassroots movement building effort. I think it's probably the only way we'll ever shift this. And if you look at other historical movements, that's certainly been the case as well, whether it's, you know, slavery or civil rights or the, you know, women's rights or what, you know, pick your issue. So I'm completely supportive. It's not an area that I have any experience in or I'm sort of not naturally drawn to be out on the streets with big signs. So it's more of a personal choice for me to pursue the what some of us like to call, you know, the need to create a new roadmap, so that when society is ready, there's some roadmap around for people to look for to try to figure out what to do. So it's sort of my little place in the massive challenge.
So in terms of bringing the wisdom of your place to the larger movement or the grassroots movement, and for those that are listening on this call today and beyond when it's captured online and whatnot, you know, people that take personal leadership seriously but don't necessarily bring a lot of capital to the table from a financial sense, how do we engage with this in a way that you feel would facilitate from the top down and from the bottom up?
Yeah. Well, I think probably the most important thing is, you know, I mean, we're sort of operating in the U.S. context. I realize there's people on the call outside the U.S., but I think the United States plays a really critical role in this because of its position in the global capitalist system. So I think as a leverage point, it may not be the, you know, the low-hanging fruit, but certainly creating a movement to apply concerted and repetitive pressure onto the both the business leaders and the political leaders of this country to put these inconsistencies on the table to force the debate in this country to address the future of capitalism itself, as opposed to our sort of left versus right bickering about how to restore the system the way it was, which is unsustainable, is critical. And I'm actually disappointed. I think the Occupy movement has I don't think it's fizzled, but it's certainly lost its momentum from anything I can tell and hear. And I think it also got a little bit off track. You know, when I first went down to visit Occupy, I was very intrigued because I learned that this slogan of, you know, the 99, we are the 99, had intentionally been not accepted by the organizing group. I forget what they called themselves, but the decision-making body of Occupy. You know, they could have said, we endorse that, and that becomes our slogan, and they didn't. And the reason for that was that they recognized that this needed to be about 100%, not the 99%, even though the injustices were, you know, largely split across the 99.1 slogan, and it was a very effective slogan. And more recently, I met with a woman who was in charge of, I guess, the social media and media strategy of Occupy, and she implied that they had actually decided that the 99 was the slogan, and it was so powerful, and that, you know, she seemed very, very much in a frame of mind to be more confrontational across the 99 versus the one. And you know, my view on that is that, you know, the power is currently held by the one, and so if we want to go down a path of confrontation, it's likely to get very, very ugly. And yet there's actually plenty of people in the one that want to help and are in alignment with these issues. And so why put yourself in a position where you make them your enemy? So at any rate, I'm disappointed that the Occupy movement hasn't evolved in a direction that's more constructive and more visible, I'm not sure what to do about that.
That definitely resonates, and you know, the service-based community, which is in some ways, you know, sharing behind the ethos of these calls, is so much aligned with that way of thinking, so much to the point where one of the members of the community, I've heard him use the word nonviolence without the hyphen between the non and the violence, where the word fundamentally shifts in meaning such that it's not the absence of violence, it's a position of love that's so great so as to be inclusive to everyone.
Yeah, that resonates with me for sure.
So, John, I know we're running out of time. We'll have to switch over into Q&A, but I wanted to ask you one more question, which I guess we've been beating around this bush for the entirety of the conversation, but you know, what do you feel are the repercussions of business as usual? If we keep doing the consumeristic tendencies that we all seem to be compelled towards, ignorantly or not, what's the realistic case as far as environment and social damage?
Well, you know the answer to that. I think we will be forced to change one way or another. But to just put it into sort of concrete terms, you know, leaving aside the social inequity and social justice issues for a moment, which obviously, you know, we could have a whole other conversation about those. But on the ecological front, if one accepts this 2-degree warming threshold as the right number, and from what I read, the scientists that understand this, if anything, believe that 2 degrees warming is too much. And I've written on this, and there's a great piece by Bill McKibben on this, if people are interested. But the implication is that we, given the 2-degree warming threshold, and given how much carbon exists in the fossil fuel reserves that we've already discovered, let alone the fossil fuel reserves that we're looking for every day, the way the arithmetic works out is we actually need to decide to not produce 80% of the oil, gas, and coal, or said differently, not burn the oil, gas, and coal that we already know exists if we're not to exceed the 2-degree threshold. And if we do go ahead and burn all of it, as we're, you know, we just need to keep doing what we're doing every day, and we're on a path to do that, you know, you can forget about 2-degree warming, and you enter into the, you know, much, much higher shift in temperature change. And you know, I'm not an expert in this. You all can make your own judgments from the research and science that you've read, but it's a world that I don't want my kids to inherit, as far as I can tell. So I mean, I think this is life and death serious for sure. I used to go around saying, what's the chance that I happen to live at the time where we could make this whole thing really implode? And, you know, the Earth's been around for 4 billion years, and what are the chances that I happen to live at the time when we had to reinvent the entire economic system in order not to destroy ourselves? And it's somewhat arrogant to look at ourselves collectively and think that we hold that burden, but I'm afraid that's certainly where the logic would suggest one one would conclude. And you know, it's the reason why I'm so intrigued with the work your group is doing, because certainly logic alone is never going to cause us to shift in to the degree that we need to shift.
Thank you, John, and thank you, Birju. We just need to transition to the Q&A part, so I'm going to turn on the Q&A queue. For those that have questions, please hit star 6, and you'll be able to get in the queue. It's an opportunity to ask. I think all questions are fair game. You know, and John has a wealth of experience and a wealth of insight, so it's really a great opportunity. Before we go to the callers, we already have callers. We'll have, I think Bill has a question.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Yeah, well, I was really heartened to hear your allusion to debt-based money and the need for constant expansion because of that. And something I've always wondered about, isn't profit basically the same principle? I mean, we get that money based on debt needs to be continually expanded in order to pay the interest, but doesn't the same principle apply with profitability, that things need to continually be expanding in order to cover the profit component of a business enterprise?
That's a great question, and it's actually one of the reasons why I'm not, and there's a number of people in this space that are totally preoccupied with the debt-based money system as the root problem.
Uh-huh.
And just as you mentioned, you know, you could imagine an economy that was built entirely on equity as opposed to debt. And I think the profit expectations actually sit above the debt service requirements, and the profit expectations are what really drive investors. So in many ways, it's the bigger issue in my mind. And that's one that we do have a choice on, though. You know, and investors can, there's two issues. One is what level of profitability is required. And there's a certain level of profitability in a business enterprise that is needed in order to have the ability to reinvest in innovation and job training and whatnot. So again, it's this issue of the expectation of exponential growth of profits which creates the problem. And then secondly, and I think really importantly, it's the idea that the presumption that profits will be reinvested exponentially. And so if we have enterprises that are not profitable, by definition, they end. And we need business enterprises to serve the needs of humanity, I would hold out. Certainly if we're going to live in a world that's at all resembling the modern world. But then what becomes really important is what the investors do with those profits, and if they get recycled back into the economy rather than reinvested and compounded, then you don't grow this juggernaut of capital needing to grow returns on it exponentially. So for example, if I make it at a very personal level, you know, I've left working on Wall Street, so my own financial capital is not growing much anymore. And if I reinvest the profits that I earn in paying for groceries and paying for my kids' education and charity, and if that's all that I ever do with my profits on my capital doesn't grow. And in a sense, I've recycled that profits back into, you know, back into the economy. And I think if one could extrapolate that model toward the aggregate of investment capital, we would have a much more sustainable model. How to do that, I don't know.
Yeah. Actually, that suggests a follow-up question. Can I ask that?
Sure, Bill.
Okay. It's like you were saying, there seems to be a constant pressure for companies to continue to grow, and it seems like most things grow and then reach a mature state where they're just stable thereafter, but companies don't do that. They seem to need to grow. And a company that's been in business for 60, 70, 80 years still is supposed to be expanding. And is there any sort of sense within the business community or the culture that maturity or stability or I hope that's clear.
You're right. I mean, you're actually right on target for a project that I'm currently working on, which is to describe what a regenerative economy would look like. And part of that would be for mature companies to behave like mature live beings, the way, you know, we all do. We grow physically through our adolescence, and then hopefully we continue to grow, but not physically and not materially. And to me, I'm a big sort of proponent of looking to natural systems for the answers to these questions. And so, you know, the role that the oak tree plays in a mature forest is very different than a weed in your garden. And unfortunately, corporations that are not really controlled by anyone because they're publicly owned, you know, they go from CEO to CEO, and they come in with a five-year view to grow the business and no perspective on the role of that business in a mature ecosystem type economy. And so I'm actually, I know this call is recorded, so this is somewhat, you know, this isn't really meant to be broadcast, but I'm trying to imagine, so what would Walmart look like if it was, if it were to mature into an oak tree rather than a continuously expansionary enterprise?
Good for you. We have your back.
Well, I'll share it with Virju when I get it written, and I'd love to get your feedback.
Yeah, we'll all love to receive it. We'll go to the next caller. We have a queue building up. If you want to get in on the queue, hit star 6.
Hi, my name is Mark. Thank you so much for taking my call. I am a young entrepreneur in the Silicon Valley, and I, way back when, read a book called Natural Capitalism by Paul Hawkins and Avery Levins, and I think they're a little bit more on the product design side of creating things that are very beneficial for the physical environment and finding out that that's incredibly profitable for the economy as well.
Right.
I have been involved in the financial world on the startup side for just a little bit and realized that in part the failures that my team and I believe have encountered are because we have not matched what is great for the customer with what is great for a business, and that in particular in the 401k space, we noticed that a lot of corporations make an extreme amount of money providing a 401k service. And I wanted to ask your thoughts on creating services that are sustainable and matching that with the profitability of a business, because we as young entrepreneurs have been focusing on sustainability to the extent that we have not been able to entice investors. Do you have any thoughts on ways that we can creatively think about that?
The phone connection is not great, so I'm struggling to hear you a little bit, and I'm also struggling to understand exactly what the question is. So can you help me? What exactly is the question, though? I mean, I get the context, but I'm struggling to figure out the question.
Sure. My question is, do you have any thoughts about profitability versus sustainability? And I noticed that the financial systems seems to seek maximum profitability.
Right.
For those who hope to create sustainable systems, is it a good goal that they also seek maximum sustainability? Or do you have a different perspective for them?
I see. Yeah. And but how is that related to 401ks?
For example, the fees that are associated with 401ks seem, in my opinion, to extract maximum profitability.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I'm with you now.
Sorry for my lack of clarity.
Yeah. No problem. So I think there's two issues here. One is that the financial services sector, somewhat of a ironic or oxymoronic name. You're absolutely right that the fundamental structure of the financial service industry and the fees that it extracts are completely, you know, in conflict with the real interests of investors. And you know, there's a reason why people that work in finance make more money than they should, which is that they've been able to extract this value from from the system and therefore from the end clients that the system serves. So that's a massive problem and a massive conversation for another time. But you're right about that. I think the other part of your question, though, is a really interesting and challenging issue, which is how do you balance the, you know, what's the optimization function for a small company and an entrepreneur like yourself? If the goal is not the simple old-fashioned maximize profit, maximize stock price, what is it? And I think this is where, you know, it's more, you know, the analogy to me is it's more of, you know, a dashboard approach than a single metric approach. And I think the overwhelming challenge that we face as a civilization right now is to create economic enterprises that actually restore natural capital, since we are in overshoot. And so a business, you know, ideally will be regenerative of natural capital. And if that's not the business that it's in, then at least it will be neutral with respect to natural capital. And that's not an optimization function. That's more of a required, you know, input. Like when you take off in an airplane, you know, if you want to fly across the country, you need a certain amount of fuel. And if you don't have that amount of fuel, you're not going to make it. So it's not that you optimize the fuel, but you have a requirement. And I think business enterprises should operate on that kind of minimal threshold with respect to the use of natural capital. And then the challenge of optimizing between financial return, which is critical to attract capital and thrive, and the social and other ecological benefits that the business generates is I think much more art than science, and that's where the beauty lies in the business world.
Thank you. We'll go to the next caller.
Thank you, Nipun. John, thank you for your gift of this time sharing with the community.
My pleasure.
Like Birju said, I was also very pleasantly awestruck about this a person from the Wall Street talking about the regenerative earth, and you know, I 100% believe and 100%. Resonated with the thought more so from my own first-hand experience, looking at what is happening in the name of the fast growth in some of the growing economies around the world, in the Asia, where I think there is a huge gap in bringing balance to the growing economy and leaving behind the ecological aspect of it. I think it's a message I strongly believe that needs to go to all these the grassroots communities where of these countries where you know the top is looking at only growing the GDP, leaving behind what's happening to the rivers, streams, and mountains and plants and you know the food growing fields.
Right.
Yeah, I totally, I was so happy to hear you, you know, express from your heart. A quick question for you is, knowing what you know now, what is that some of the, you know, thing that we as, you know, ordinary people can start doing to bring about that shift?
I wish I had a really easy answer, a quick answer. We wrestle with that all the time, but I do think that I think there needs to be this movement building work. And, you know, there's a revolution that needs to happen. And I don't mean that in any kind of an armed conflict sense, obviously, but there's a need to shift our core belief system. And I believe that only happens through, you know, numerous grassroots movements that build from the bottom up that someday kind of join in a chorus and get heard. And so, I think having a, the idea that we need a new economy on the table and being discussed, eventually will get the attention of the what I like to call the people running the world, which are essentially the political elites and the business and in particular the financial elites. But right now, that voice, my voice and that voice is invisible, and the debate that we hear, as you just said, is how do we generate GDP growth? And there's actually some hopeful signs, and just as one example, a friend of mine who's deeply committed to this work and aware of these issues just gave me a book that Prince Charles wrote. So, Prince Charles totally gets all this, and he's now committed to using the platform he has to raise awareness. And my guess is, I've never spoken to him, but my guess is he finds this a monumental, almost impossible task. And he's, he's got a pretty interesting platform to be a change agent. And so I think it's the collective effort of everybody from you and I to Prince Charles, raising these questions and raising awareness. And eventually, we'll have a political debate in the United States where these issues are on the table. That's the best answer I can give you.
Yeah. Charles, just to, sorry, John, just to jump in, I was wondering if you had any thoughts on movements like gross national happiness in Bhutan and elsewhere. It seems like there's a lot of interest in these different kinds of metrics. Have you looked into that? And if so, what's your thinking on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very familiar with these, not at a technical detail level, but at a conceptual level, and I work closely with the New Economics Foundation in London, who's promoted the happiness and got a lot of interest from the press in it. I think they said that their report was downloaded a million times from their website when it first came out. And one of my colleagues in this work, Bob Costanza, is very involved in the work with Bhutan on the happiness indicator. I think it's great. My reservation is that it's easy to it's too easy to dismiss it if you're a kind of hardened mainstream policymaker, because it's sort of soft and nebulous. So my only concern about it is that it might trivialize the urgency of these issues. And so, here's a alternative path that I'm involved in. And I'd be curious, people will probably disagree with this, but the U.S. military at the very highest levels, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is the recently retired one, Admiral Mullen, is quite aware of these issues, particularly the ecological carbon issues, and also the exponential growth and debt issues. And somehow, if we had a sense of military urgency that this is a national and global security crisis, that feels, in a sense, hardcore and indisputable, whereas the "we want more happiness" obviously has a softer, in many ways, more real and beautiful ring to it, but I'm not sure it has the ability to create the sense of urgency the way, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff can, if he stands up and says we need to change our economy, which I hope someday he will do. So I think it's not a question of either or, but all of the above. So I think happiness work is a critical piece of a much bigger challenge.
Agreed. We'll go to the next caller. And again, if you have a question, hit *6 and you'll be in the queue.
Hi, this is Yumi from Vancouver. John, thank you very much for your time. I want to touch on something that you mentioned in terms of the time horizon for the kind of investments that you do. You mentioned long term, but long term, the definition of long term seems to be different in every sector. And I know that, excuse me, in the 80s, even in the financial sector, long-term meant something like 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that it no longer means that anymore. You know, if it's 10 years, I would be surprised. So yeah. From your investment perspective, what is the timeline that your investors tolerate in terms of the type of investments that you do?
It's a great question, and you're making a great point. And I'm sorry, was it Elaine is your name?
It's Yumi, like you and
Yumi,
you.
Okay, I'm sorry. So I actually wrote a little bit about this, that the, you know, there's a lot of focus on short-termism now and as a core problem of our capital markets, and that ranges from the high-frequency trading issue, which is literally trading in nanoseconds, but also to the, you know, the kind of quarter-to-quarter focus of corporations and therefore the investment community focus on quarterly earnings. And there's lots of documentation showing that the average holding period of equities has gone from, I forget the numbers, but most, you know, even your basic garden variety Fidelity mutual fund trades stocks, you know, turns over the portfolio certainly more than once a year and often several times a year. So, but your question really has the answer embedded in it. To me, the issues that I'm talking about and that are the crisis facing our society are issues of multi-generational challenges, and the thought of even keeping track of this in any meaningful way on a quarter-to-quarter basis is just sort of ridiculous. And that points to one of the problems, which is that because the interest rate is used to discount future outcomes, both good and bad, it tends to put a huge premium on the outcomes of business and our economy that occur in the short term. And what I would call short term would be, say, the first 5 years or the next 5 years of the business. I love the seventh generation idea. I don't know of the American Indians. I don't know if we'll ever get the business community to think really in terms of seventh generation, but we certainly need to make investment decisions with the idea that they're not short-term. And you know, it's interesting that the venture capital world has a term, exit. And when you exit investment is when you sell it, and a lot of times the exit is the goal of the investment. And I would turn it the other way around. And in fact, the projects that I'm involved in with Burju, you know, we don't have a planned exit. There's no reason you need to exit an investment if you're trying to align capital with these long-term purposes. But there's a lot of work to do on that. On that subject.
Thank you.
We'll go to our next caller here.
Hi, John. Thank you so much. I have a non-finance related question. So how do your former colleagues feel about the work that you're doing now? Do you sometimes feel that you're being judged? And if yes, how do you kind of navigate if there is any awkwardness or that kind of thing?
It's interesting. I don't know if I could make a general statement. I think there's a number of my former colleagues who more than like they try to criticize what I say by sending me an email after I write a blog and raise a point or question something I say, but in reality, I know that I've got them thinking about it because otherwise they wouldn't be reading the stuff. And then there's a small minority of my former colleagues who I would say totally get what I'm doing or who have come to an appreciation of it, typically after being one of the people questioning it. And then I'd say probably the majority of them think that I'm off on some, tilting at windmills exercise, and have just sort of lost interest. I'd say that's probably 3/4 of them.
Yeah. Thank you.
We'll go to our last caller here.
John, this is Ram. I had a question on if there was a price placed on natural capital, you know, something along the lines of what companies like Puma and Dow are doing, do you think that would take care of this problem? Or is it bigger than just putting a price on natural capital?
Yeah. So it's a great question. Another long conversation. There's actually an interesting conversation on our website on this exact subject with a lot of thoughtful people contributing. If you go and search for ecosystem services, I think you'll find it. But the gist of it is that I think there's both a great need and a great danger in putting, you know, the idea of we need to get the prices right. And the opportunity is that clearly the price signal is a massive lever to shift the flow of the direction of the economy. And so if I could have one wish that could be granted and immediately implemented, it would be to put a very substantial tax on carbon to trigger that price signal you're talking about. But I think there's also a danger in thinking that, quote, all we have to do is get the prices right. And I'll use an example to demonstrate why that's so. Well, there's two reasons. One, there's two problems with it. One is it presumes we could ever know what the right prices are and that we could ever measure all of the things that we need to price. And you know, it's one thing to think that we know how to put a price on carbon, but it's another thing to figure out what it means to price biodiversity and you know, what's the price of damaging or creating risks to a particular species or a particular set of subspecies that, you know, many of which we haven't even discovered yet, much less understand the role they play in the web of life. So I think there's an arrogance about the thinking that we could actually accomplish this even if we thought it would work. But the second problem is that the idea of putting a price on externalities presumes that there is a price for everything, and that if you pay a high enough price, you can purchase it. And in, you know, the example I like to give is, you know, there's what's the fair price, or what is the price any of us would be willing to pay for our first glass of water of the day? And of course, the answer is that's priceless, and we're dead if we don't get it. And so then you end up having this problem of you know, scarce critical resources flowing to the people that have the most money. And in many ways, because we're bumping into these boundaries, we're already seeing the global economy shifting in that direction. And it's a very dangerous kind of direction to be heading. And I think the, you know, it sort of forces a realization that if there are finite resources, critical resources, there needs to be some system of thrift and allocation that is not a market-based system. And that's a complicated one for our current kind of worldview to grapple with. And you immediately get into discussions of, oh, you're promoting socialism or you're promoting centralized planning. And those are real challenges.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. One last question as a way to conclude our call. You spoke a little bit about seventh generation, and the last time we met, you also spoke a little bit about parenting. And there's this ethos of just being this ethic, I think, of being a steward for those that come after you. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about what parenting. How parenting has informed your value system, and if it has changed some of it in any way at all?
That's a good question. Well, I have three kids, aged 21 to 16, and there's no question that the burden I feel that my kids will be bearing is, I don't know if I would say it's driving my intensity and my passion, but it's certainly a major factor in my work. I feel more of a personal responsibility to society than just my own children, but obviously thinking through the world my children will grow old in is a major motivator here. I guess the flip side of it is, though, one of the most hopeful things I see is that the kids, my children's generation and older, the kids I speak to in college and in even out of college, but young, they don't need to be told any of the stuff I'm trying to figure out. They intuit it. They know it. And they're already on to kind of working on solutions and working in a different paradigm than the one that kind of currently operates in the world. And so in many ways, our task is to be, very humble and to do what we can to support and assist, my kids' generation and then in a sense get out of the way rather than to think that the burden lies on ourselves only to solve this. And you just look at this whole social media phenomenon and the impact that's had around the world. And, that's all very promising. And so, I think the legacy we have and what we're leaving to our kids it's a humbling thought to contemplate. So I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, no, that's great. Birju, you want to conclude with some final thoughts and perhaps lead us into the minute of silent gratitude?
Absolutely. Thanks, Nipun, and thank you, John, for your time today. There's just been so many places over the last few years that I've had the blessings to be able to connect with you that I've been so inspired by your thinking. Your ability to blend nature and really the ineffable with the pragmatic financial is something that I think we're all grateful for on this call. If we wanted to connect more with your work, how could we do that?
I would be delighted. First thing to do is go to our website, capitalinstitute.org, and if you like, sign up we send out a almost weekly newsletter, which is really my blog and a few updates on things that we're working on or following that relate to this subject matter. And then please engage. I love to hear from people their reactions and their thoughts on the ideas that we're putting out. And I'd welcome anyone's ideas on how to get this message and this work out to a broader audience and how to make it relevant to the grassroots movement building work that needs to be done. So I'd be very grateful for that if people are interested to dig deeper. But it's capitalinstitute.org, and start there and shoot me a note if you're interested. I'd be happy to continue the engagement.
Thanks again, John.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Service Space.
Thank you.